Today at Reader's Corner, Pulitzer Prize winner Ron Powers, author of Mark Twain, A Life.
The life as he lived it, and that life was absolutely gigantic. I mean, that man strode through the 19th century. He was everywhere. I can't think of another author who got out and around and looked America straight in the eye and heard America talking and then got it right. He was the first writer to have the genius and the talent to bring vernacular into literature and elevate it. He really did transform the way that Americans wrote books.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. From his biting sarcasm to his witty social commentary, Mark Twain defined a bygone era. His classic literary works continue to enthrall readers of all ages. Today's guest author, Ron Powers, spoke at Boise State in February as part of Read Me Treasure Valley, and I'm pleased to welcome him to our program today. Growing up in Hannibal, Missouri, as the son of a Fuller Brush salesman, Mr. Powers spent his childhood in the shadow of Mark Twain. As a writer himself, it's no wonder he felt a connection to the town's most famous citizen. Mr. Powers is the author of 10 books, including Mark Twain, A Life, and Dangerous Water, a biography of the boy who became Mark Twain. He is co-author with James Bradley of the New York Times bestseller Flags of Our Fathers, about the famous raising of the flag on Iwo Jima in 1945. Mr. Powers won a Pulitzer Prize in 1973 for his critical writing about television for the Chicago Sun-Times. He was the first television critic ever to win the Pulitzer. Mr. Powers joins us today by phone from his home in Castleton, Vermont. Ron Powers, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob. I'm really happy to be on your show, and I truly enjoyed my visit to Boise a few weeks ago. It is a lovely little city with a lot of good arts and a lot of very interesting writers who live there.
Well, we heard so many favorable reactions from folks after your visit that it's really great to have a chance to follow up for a few minutes. How many biographies have been written on Mark Twain?
Oh, lots, Bob, lots. In fact, so many have been written about him that I ran the opposite direction from him for many, many years. I did grow up in his hometown, and I'm old enough now that I have to tell people that I did not know him personally. When I tell that to a college student, he or she will say, oh, okay.
Yeah, right. I hear you.
But I'll tell you, I felt his presence in Hannibal. He was everywhere. His silhouette was on the back of produce trucks, and we went to movies at the Tom Sawyer Theater and had lunch at the Huck Finn Burger Bar. But yes, he has been thoroughly examined. I think I've counted something like 40, either full or partial biographies of him. You know, partial meaning his friendship with Ulysses S. Grant or William Dean Howells. So I wondered for a long time whether there was anything more to say about him, and I found that there was.
Well, would it be safe to assume that this is the only biography of Mark Twain written by a Hannibal boy?
I suspect it probably is. And I'll tell you, one of my dreads was that the first book review would say, Hannibal boy screws up life of Mark Twain. But that didn't happen. But I'll tell you, the thing that I found missing, and some of the biographies are truly excellent. The one by Justin Kaplan in 1966, which is called Mr. Clemens and Mark Twain, was a triumphal biography. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and it really pulled him back out of obscurity. But I have found that most of his biographers have been academics, which is fine. They have been very theory-driven, and they have been sort of argumentative, and they tend to, examine him like a collection of used parts at an auto repair shop, and they got to put them all back together. And as I say, that's all well and good. That's a legitimate way of creating a biography. What I found missing, for the most part, was the life as he lived it, and that life was absolutely gigantic. I mean, that man strode through the 19th century. He was everywhere. He was like that. You remember that old Woody Allen character Zelig, who
yes,
he was everywhere. He appeared in newsreels and photographs and everywhere something was happening. Well, Mark Twain was the real Zelig. He explored the Wild West and the Mississippi River and the banking and financial elites of the East and the politicians. And he also investigated Black America, which in his lifetime, of course, until the Civil War, was slave America. I can't think of another author who got out and around and looked America straight in the eye and heard America talking and then got it right to the extent that this man did.
Well, you mentioned the Mississippi River. I grew up very close to the Mississippi River in St. Louis. And here you are from Hannibal, just up the river, so to speak.
Right.
I wonder, when you were growing up in Hannibal, was the Mississippi River anywhere near the kind of influence on your young life and your later writing life that it,
oh,
that
it
was in? Yeah, yeah, the same
it,
for
it,
me.
I'd like to hear you talk about what kind of influence it had on your life, because I think rivers are very powerful. They're powerful psychically. And, you know, here was Hannibal. Here was this little remote town that was out there on the prairie. And as you say, St. Louis was the closest big city. And there were no, in my boyhood, there were no, really no interstates. It was hard to get to. But that river brought the world to Hannibal, as it did in Mark Twain's time. I mean, it brought excursion boats after the Second World War was over. You could see the amphibious boats that were used in the war floating down, and they would tie up at the docks, and people would come and look at them. So the river made us feel special, and I think I identified with it in the same way that Sam did, Sam Clemens, before he was Mark Twain, sure.
Now, of course, he was born in 1835. He died in 1910. So this is a 19th century life for the most part. And
right,
the Civil War is the seminal event in this man's life. And he actually did play a role in that. I think you talk about how he was soldiering for a while.
Yes, for a while, for 3 weeks. but he signed up with a little group of ragtag would-be rebels called the Marion Rangers. They may not even have been officially conscripted into the army. And he showed up for battle on a mule. His feet were nearly touching the ground. He was armed with an umbrella and a length of rope and a couple of other things. And so these guys, they sort of drilled. They held their drills around the state for a while. And meantime, this figure was moving steadily down from the north, a colonel in a Union regiment who was going after them. His name was Grant. And if he and his regiment had not stopped to build a bridge across a river, and he would have met Mark Twain's, Sam Clemens's Marion Rangers right on the very ground in Florida, Missouri, where Mark Twain was born. Imagine that. And the other irony, Bob, is that, you know, Sam narrowly escaped Grant's soldier, his general, you know, his military skills. But later in life, they became great friends. Mark Twain venerated him. He, you know, knowing Grant helped him lose his southernness. And at the end of Grant's life, Mark Twain encouraged him to write his memoirs, which became one of the great pieces of war literature ever written. And Grant wrote the final page about a week after he died of throat cancer.
And as a matter of fact, a friend of mine from Kentucky named Bracelin Flood has written a book about Grant's last year on the earth. But this gentleman, Bracelin Flood, is an expert on Grant. What a fascinating story about Twain. But you didn't mention that, and I guess those of us from Missouri who call ourselves the residents of a border state in those days might be able to assume this, but Sam Clemens went in on the Confederate side when he joined up. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it was kind of reflexive. You know, one of the great controversies about Mark Twain, Sam Clemens, is whether he was a racist. Of course, that term didn't exist in his lifetime. But the question was, did he feel that blacks, they weren't even African Americans for much of his life, they were Africans, they were slaves, did he look down on them? And I can authoritatively tell you, Bob, that he did not. And there is so much evidence in his writings that he felt a great sense of humanity on behalf of not only black people, but Chinese, all you know, the immigrants who came to America. And he got that from his mother, Jane, who was this little tiny red-haired Kentucky Spitfire who hardly ever learned to read, but she herself had a great heart and once rushed out in the street in front of their house in Hannibal with her with an umbrella and started knocking around a guy who was abusing a slave. And Jane was a powerful influence on Sam's life, and his instincts were always humane, and he had a reformist soul. So the joining up with the Confederates was, he was barely giving it a thought. It was sort of the next thing to do. And then he went west to sit out the Civil War, and that's where he really learned to write the language of America.
So, in a sense, he was a deserter. He tried it out, didn't like it, and walked away from it.
Well, he did, and you know, late he wrote. He stayed in the Civil War long enough to write one of the two really enduring pieces of literature that were written by someone who participated in the war. Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage, and there was Sam's A Private History of a Campaign That Failed. It starts out as a comic look at a bunch of bumbling soldiers who kept rolling off, or recruits who kept falling off their horses and getting saddle sore. But in the middle of the story, the mood changes, and they are doing sentinel duty at night, and a figure approaches on horseback, silhouetted, and you know, they can't tell whether he's even in or out of uniform. They fire at him, and he falls off his horse and dies. And then they run to him, and they find a man wearing civilian clothes with a picture photograph of his wife and children. That incident, whether it happened or not, and something like it probably did, sickened Mark Twain on warfare forever. Mm-hmm. And it turned him away from even being a participant. And I think that's probably why he left the war.
You mentioned his charge of racism. My only recollection of Samuel Clemens in that regard is in regard to Huckleberry Finn and perhaps the use of the dialect. And yep. And I learned in your book, I think it was in your book I read, where it wasn't until 1957 that the NAACP charged that Huckleberry Finn was a racist book, or Clemens in writing it was.
Right.
So I guess the question is, in his day, you've already mentioned that racist wasn't even a word. In his day, was he charged with being prejudiced, or is this just something that came later as his book, Huck Finn, moved through the generations?
Well, that's a great phrase that you just used, moves through the generations, because like any great work of literature, Huckleberry Finn seems to change. And it meets the needs of a certain age, or doesn't meet the needs. You know, in his lifetime, it was criticized for its slang and coarse language. At the onset of World War I, Huckleberry Finn was lionized as a classic American figure, the adventuring boy, and he was sort of seen through a patriotic prism. And now let's think about that year, 1957, Bob. That was the year of the Brown versus the Board of Education decision by the Supreme Court that integrated American public school classrooms. And that integration opened up this book to a segment of Americans who had not really had occasion to read it before. And when that terrible word, which is probably the ugliest word in the English language, the most, it's like a percussive slap in the face if you're on the receiving end of it and are a person of color, the shock waves were so great because the word, you know, drowned out its context in a way. It was just this man's character saying that word again and again and again. That controversy lasted something like 30 years, and it probably hasn't completely died down yet. But if you look on through the book and watch the behavior of Huck Finn and Jim, you realize that they were equals, and that Huck thought of Jim as an equal. There's a wonderful, I think it's a chapter 15. I'll try to make this really quick. the two of them are on the raft. It's nighttime. Huck gets off the raft into a little canoe and goes looking for an island to tie the boat up. He gets lost in the fog and is a long time coming back. Jim, on the raft, is beside himself with anxiety. He thinks he's lost his friend, and he finally falls asleep. Huck Finn comes back, sees Jim asleep, and decides to play a prank on him. He pretends to be his own ghost. And when Jim finally gets it that he's being made a fool of, he lectures Huck and says, "You is trash. Trash is what people is that play tricks on their friends." And 15 minutes later, Huck goes to Jim and asks his forgiveness. In other words, he recognizes Jim's humanity. He recognizes his own transgression. Bob Hurst, who's the editor-in-chief of the Mark Twain Archives out at Berkeley, maintains that this is the first time in American literature, and maybe the only time, in which a white character apologizes to a black. I think that is very powerful evidence of where Mark Twain's sensibilities lay.
I guess. Well, you mentioned that he went west. What does he learn out west? Apparently, he learns out west that he's a writer. And then that has to do with the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County.
Right, right.
Tell us about that.
It was out west where people felt free to speak in their own vernacular, their own plain-spoken, blunt, ground zero kind of dialogue. These were tough customers. They were gamblers. They were speculators, opportunists of all kinds, men who fought duels. I think there's a rumor that there were even some lawyers out there. It was just awful. But and Sam heard it because he really heard language. I think he heard language as music. Now, the significance of the West is that it was far from the reach of these great, dignified men of learning, Ralph Waldo Emerson and Fenimore Cooper and the Brahmins, the transcendentalists, who were trying to uplift Americans and give them a sense of high diction and politeness. And those were good intentions. But that didn't fit the character of the country. This was a new, scrambling, entrepreneurial, scrappy, forward-looking nation. And the language that people used reflected that. He alone, he was the first writer to have the genius and the talent to bring vernacular into literature and elevate it. He really did transform the way that Americans wrote books. He probably made it safe for people like me, Philip Rush Mann's son, who doesn't have an advanced degree, to enter the journalistic trade. I am Middle America, and my path was made easier by Mark Twain's pioneering honoring of plain talk.
You're listening to Ron Powers. He is the author of Mark Twain, A Life. I have to ask you, Mark, or excuse me, Ron, what you
I've
thought?
I've been called worse.
You've been called. That's a good thing to be called, Mark Twain. What did you think of the release of Mark Twain's autobiography?
Yeah.
Of Samuel Clemens, I think that it's out. Volume one is out,
yeah.
And I think volume two and three are quickly to follow. But I'm just wondering, as a biographer of Mark Twain, how do you feel about the autobiography coming out? In this case, many, many years later, according to his wishes, he did not want that autobiography
right.
out in his lifetime. Help us understand that. What was going on in his life, and why would he do this, write a biography, and what do you think of it?
Well, I mean, the fact that he didn't want it to be published until 100 years after his death, I really think that reflects the time he lived in. This was the tail end of the Victorian era, and although society was changing and growing more secular, and there was maybe a little bit more tolerance for the more outlandish of his satirical views, people were not used to books that, you know, made fun of God, made fun of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, as he did in the Diaries of Adam and Eve. But if you compare what he considered scandalous with anything by, you know, Bret Easton Ellis or any of these confessional biographies that are pouring out in our time, it was pretty mild. you know, I was very happily surprised that that big, thick doorstop of the book became a bestseller on the New York Times list and stayed there for several weeks, because it tells me that Americans still feel a very strong connection. I think of Mark Twain as the inventor of time present. I think he was right there at the forefront of what we call modernism. But, you know, as for the quality of what's in the books, I don't think that, certainly not in Volume 1, which is the book you're talking about that's out now, there's nothing really scandalous or revelatory, you know, by our standards. But what you get when you read it is how fascinated this man was, how curious he was about just about everything that happened to him. He could go on for pages, for instance, about London taxi drivers and character descriptions of the great and also of anonymous people. He had what is called, I love this phrase, radical amazement. It's like everything he saw or heard or did was the most important thing that had happened since the beginning of time. And we can share that fascination because of the quality of his prose.
He also traveled to Europe, and I think some have said that he might have been his generation's answer to Benjamin Franklin in his days in Paris. How do you make that comparison?
Well, I think they were different creatures, except, you know, Franklin was sort of a diplomat and an inventor. He was the great man of his time. There's no question about that. What they have in common was, as I said earlier in the show, they got up and out of the study of the halls of government in Franklin's case or the Society of Philadelphia, and explored and ventured abroad. And when I go to writers' conferences or talk to young writers, I say, let's not talk about technique or style or metaphor yet. Let's talk about crossing that boundary into the unknown and encountering it and then chronicling it. So I think both Franklin, who became a popular hero in France, and Mark Twain, who by the time of his death was beloved around the world, were men who did that.
So he wrote Innocents Abroad about the trip through Europe. Is that like a Bill Bryson effort today, if people haven't read Innocents Abroad? Where would you go to find something that today that might look something like that?
Yeah, but I hadn't thought of that. Bryson is just wonderfully
fascinating.
Isn't he,
though? Fascinating. Yeah.
But what the Innocents Abroad changed was this kind of American tendency to kneel down before old Europe and all of its castles and cathedrals and tombs and its great traditions. Mark Twain went strutting over there, put his hands in his pockets, rocked back on his heels. He looked at the Michelangelo the Sistine Chapel, and he said, you know, we got painters over in America that use brighter colors than that, and the painting isn't as chipped, you know. He just, he dared to puncture that pretense, which was really damaging to young America. We hadn't gotten over our inferiority complex toward Europe, and The Innocents Abroad was one of the great transformative books that helped us do that.
And he did get semi-biographical, semi-autobiographical, I should say, in his account of the West called Roughing It.
Yeah. Well, that's another example of him, you know, that was not only a wonderful book, it was heroic. You know, he getting to the West was not easy in those days. Took a stagecoach route. He went over the Rockies with his brother Orion. He encountered genuine desperados, a guy named Slade who wore a black hat, and Mark Twain wrote about him. He became the archetype of all those 1930s movie bad guys. And he met artists out there, you know, who looked at the world with a different perspective than the people of Boston. And he got it all down, and because of his mastery of the way people talked, again, he brought it back east, and book readers devoured it.
Well, he wound up being an East Coast kind of guy, and in the course of his East Coast life, he met many interesting people, and you mentioned some of the transcendentalists that he certainly knew and read about. But I guess I'm curious as to his political humorist side. And if he were alive today, where would he be on the political spectrum? Who might you compare him to today if you're looking at those critics and those humorists who are commenting on politics in America in 2012? Where do you put Samuel Clemens?
Well, I don't think he would have had very different opinions than he did back then. I mean, you know, I think the depravities of human nature as they're reflected in politics don't change very much. He was famous for saying, suppose you were an idiot, and suppose you were a member of Congress, but I repeat myself. And, you know, things like whiskey is carried into the Senate in demijohns and carried out in demagogues. So I think one of the things that makes him great is that he understood human nature better than just about anybody who ever lived. That's why you can translate him into Russian, into Japanese, into French. He might have been horrified to have been translated into French. But people understand him because he got the way people think and behave. And that behavior, as shocked as we can be by some of the vulgarity and the aggression and the personal attacks of present-day politics, it was back there back then. It wasn't amplified on YouTube and Facebook, but it was there, and Sam was there to set it down in print.
You know, there are many authors who, with the family life Samuel Clemens had, the children he lost, could have walked away a much different character than Samuel Clemens did. Yes. Could you help us understand? And that's what I think is so brilliant about your book, the way you do point out the way he lived his life. But this is a guy who had a rough life when it comes to the family side of the man.
Oh, for sure. He suffered. He suffered bereavement all of his life, starting in childhood when he lost a couple of siblings that were younger than he, and Jane took him into the room where a brother and a sister both died and made him put his hand on their forehead. She was sort of an hysterical woman. And that stayed with him all his life. He had a very strong sense of guilt over things that happened to other people. He lost his brother Henry in a steamboat explosion when Henry was 19 and Sam was just a few years older. And he blamed himself because he'd gotten Henry the position on the steamboat. He never forgave himself for things like that. But as Justin Kaplan, whom I mentioned, you know, a few minutes ago, as Kaplan pointed out, he saved himself from going insane by converting his grief into art. He never stopped writing. He never stopped processing. And, of course, he said about humor, the true source of humor is not joy but sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. I think nobody who lived in the 19th century was more qualified to make an analysis like that than Mark Twain.
Well, we all have best friendships that help us get through these very difficult times. And in Samuel Clemens' case, it was William Dean Howells. Can you tell us just briefly about that friendship?
Oh, I love that friendship. In a way, they were very much alike. They were Midwestern boys who fell in love with words. Howells was sort of the good boy, and Sam was the bad boy, and the friendship they enjoyed, each gave to the other. Howells was this little sort of plump, moist, dutiful young man who had a big walrus mustache and parted his hair on the side. And Howells, when he was an associate editor at the Atlantic magazine one day, he picked up a manuscript called The Innocents Abroad. He read it. He was taken by it. He was an honest enough man to say, there is enough pure, unadulterated humor in this book to make it an American classic. He said, Mr. Clemens is quite worthy of the company of the best. And that really launched Mark Twain's career as a respectable Eastern writer. The friendship, the two of them, they went to baseball games together. They got stuck in the mud trying to get to Centennial. I think that's just a really precious friendship that they enjoyed, and I loved writing about it.
Ron, I so much enjoyed the book. We've run out of time, but I certainly appreciate I know we all appreciate your visit to Boise. It was a wonderful opportunity for us to link up with Mark Twain, the author, and Ron Powers, the author. Thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
It's been a great pleasure, Bob. Thank you.
Again, the name of the book, Mark Twain, A Life by Ron Powers. Next week, photographer Matthew Darin, author of A Forgotten Wilderness, Nature's Hidden Relationship in West Central Idaho. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.